I know that over the past few days you have been, well, I don't know if smothered is the word, but with amenities, so I believe that we should get right into the this morning's program. And first we will call for summary reports from the chairman or the particular member of the workshop that had been assigned to make the summary reports. At the outset, and the first summary that we will hear this morning will be from John C. Doyle, Executive Director of the Alaska Legislative Affairs Agency. Jack, we'd be happy to hear from you and have you present your summary at this time.
Thank you, Mr. President, Governor, statesperson. I'm trying to determine first how many of those who were in our workshop are here so they won't be grumbling too much. I'm just...
We have Mr. Casella and Vic Fisher come up here.
The legislative branch workshop was, if I say so myself, the very finest one held at least yesterday. It's naturally a subject very, very close to my heart and my livelihood, and I think it was an excellent one. In fact, it was so good we ran overtime and left a few people mad. I regret we didn't get a chance to have all the delegates present who had been at the convention, who were at our workshop, a chance to say something, although most of them did, one of them twice. And anyway, the persons present, we had really pleased to have Steve McCutcheon there, who was chairman of the Legislative Article Committee at the convention, and the current Speaker of the House, Mike Bradner, and former Speaker Tom Fink, a junior member of the legislature as far as service goes, but not in aptitude, Clark Greening, and then particularly happy to have Fred Pratt of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, who was a member of the working press and observed the legislative operation, really made a contribution too. I think we followed the general format suggested by Vic, that we had the delegate give us the background of the problems or attitudes prevailing at the time of the convention regarding legislative structure and powers, tracing it even as far back as from the time of purchase up through the lack of a legislative body to the first one of 1913, when we had a half-hearted territorial authority, very weak powers, limited sessions, an appointed governor, the limited sessions meaning that once you went home after 60 days, our friends in the skeletal executive branch did what they pleased anyway. So with an excellent background from Delegate McCutcheon, and I did recall at the time that in our office still, in Legislative Affairs Agency, we invoke his spirit and words, probably to his chagrin, as justifying or explaining what we have now and why it is there. And we've learned to use the debates at the convention, the committee reports, to suggest that if someone thinks something's an issue, I say if the delegates didn't think it was considered routine and therefore not controversial. And it's our way of justifying things. And despite my fears and rumors that Delegate McCutcheon had become less enamored of the article, as someone near and dear to us has of the executive branch, he did uphold the article, and I think in summary I could say regarding that the legislative article is held up well, and there are several suggestions that have been made for some changes, but interestingly enough, except for maybe changing the apportionment of the Senate and maybe the size of the Senate, all the suggestions, and maybe a unicameral if you want to get into that all the changes that were suggested, hinted at, or talked about could be done by changes in law, which the legislature is a lawmaking body, or by legislative rule, or by just exercising some internal discipline and leadership. The audience participation was very lively and contributed greatly to the discussion. I say I wish we'd had more time. But we did talk about the unicameral, and interestingly enough, everybody seemed to feel that we knew why the convention supposedly didn't adopt it. We knew that we were trying to sell something to Congress, and that was hard enough without going into something that looked a little bit too much like a revival of George Norris's unicameral. But it was noted by Mr. McCutcheon and others that we picked up some of the unicameral aspects. Sitting as one house to treat with appointments and executive vetoes, and having uniform rules. But the unicameral thing was interesting in that no one really endorsed it, no one wholly rejected it, and it was suggested that it might be something down the line. In the meantime, the alleged real or suspicioned fault of the bicameral that we have with the unicameral modifications, it could be treated by law or rule or decisions of the electorate. There was a lot of discussion also of the evils of the so-called evils of the Free Conference Committee, something again near and dear to us who are seeking something to be done on the quiet, or something which we in righteous anger can say is a plot against democracy, depending, as the speaker said, as to whose ox is being gored. Recently, I was being interviewed on the subject of the unicameral. Being an authority on this since in 1950, I wrote a paper on it. And the interviewer, full of enthusiasm, peculiar to those who have not gotten by age 25, said, "Now, wouldn't this solve the problem of the Free Conference Committee?" And I thought how he knew and I knew that his current employment was based upon a little quiet decision made in a Free Conference Committee. But I said that don't give me this jazz about the evils of the Free Conference Committee and say the unicameral will solve it. The Free Conference Committee is a creature of the public want, need, and pressure, and of the legislature, and it could be abolished by a ruling from the chair, practically, easily by a rule, requirements for notice and publication, and time for consideration. So it's, if we want the unicameral, we should have better reasons than saying abolish the Free Conference Committee, which very few people understand, and I must say, even some members of the legislature, I do not think, understand it. I mentioned in our report that we talked about salaries and allowances and time limits. All are being handled one way or the other, and time limits can again be handled by rule, law, internal discipline and leadership, with no reference to amending the Constitution as it now is, because the article is very sound. And whether or not you think it's lived up to the promise of 1955-56, or what one had hoped then, again, it's a matter of a personal opinion. But I did mention in this brief summary, Mr. President, the electorate. And I have become a little more cynical in the recent years because I think I had the enthusiasm of a so-called political science major at one time, and here in Alaska particularly. But after looking at in this biennial season of primaries and general elections and candidacies for public office, and listening to some of the ads and reading the ads and editorials, I'm getting a little discouraged. And I think the most of the faults that we attribute to the legislature or to the governor's side or possibly to the courts is based upon ignorance, which is born of apathy, poor education, maybe poor press, maybe our own laziness or our inability to articulate what government is all about. And I do go back to the electorate, and you know, you can always say we get what we voted for and what we deserve. And I think in the legislature, we always say the guy that we voted for, particularly if he won, if he's the only good one, but somehow when he got to the Capitol, he or she has been seduced by evil companions. And it's collectively we can't stand the group, but individually we know there's some really good folks there. Well, I read an editorial this spring during the as primary time approached, and this distinguished editor roundly criticized an incumbent legislator for committing the ultimate crime. He was accused of representing his district and his people too well. Well, that's an awful thing to say, but I'm sure he's going to win on that basis. He can turn that editorial around in his district and win. But this was supposedly from a sophisticated newspaper and editorial staff. And I heard a local ad yesterday on the radio where a local citizen is seeking voter approval for his candidacy to legislative office, suggesting we take a few million away from the Southeast Alaska ferry system and pump it into the troopers or the highway patrol, and somehow that's going to bring peace and respectable prosperity to 2 Street here in Fairbanks. Somehow we missed the Pope someplace in letting it know what you do when you go to Juneau, what your powers are, or wherever the capital might be, and what the governor can do and can't do. And if we put up with this sort of thing, even in a sophisticated group such as we have here, and tell each other these outrageous stories and what we're going to do and can't do, it just seems that we really can't expect the general electorate, if we fail through our government processes and through our schools and through our press, to tell it like it is, that our discussions here of more sophisticated structure and arrangement and the powers of a given branch of government, that we somehow are not going to get out to the troops who are again going to be returning new people to the Capitol to learn the hard way and maybe come back home whipped after a couple of years, or return down there and pretend that they have to pretend what they're doing there and not tell the people back at home, because people at home would be too bored. The press find there's no glamour in it, there's no great issues, and therefore no matter what we set up in the way of a revised legislative branch, way of structure or powers, it's not going to make a tinker's dam. I'm a little discouraged about that, because I have a great enthusiasm for this branch, and this meeting yesterday was a great meeting. But the trouble was, we all felt like we were the cream of the crop there. We had the delegates to the convention, interested and concerned citizens, and we had avid students there, and we had incumbent state officials, and had a great discussion, and got off in a few flights of fancy and expressed some discouragement and some hope, but we're sort of insulated. And I just feel, Mr. President, that somehow we failed over the years to have the more enlightened electorate, the better informed, the more prying electorate, the more demanding electorate than maybe we'd hoped for 20 years ago with the oncoming of statehood and the adoption of this Constitution. I say, a little discouraged, not completely, but I think we failed within the legislative side and government in general, but I don't let the press off, or the lazy public, or the school system, whether it's secondary or higher, that somehow we just are not equipped to be alert, good citizens and demand the best of the elected or appointed officials up and down the line. Mr. President, with that cheery note, I will end my very brief summary, which got too long. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jack Doyle, and that really was an inspiring summary. I'm certain that everyone will agree with that. I do appreciate it very much. Now, we will now call on Catherine Fanning, editor and publisher of the Anchorage Daily News, as chairman of the Human Rights and Public Responsibilities Workshop. Kay, if you would come forward, please make your summary.
Thank you, Governor Egan. I think many of us put these summaries together in the wee hours of the morning, so I hope I can read mine. I'll do my best. Our panel consisted of Dorothy Holland, who was the delegate to the convention in 55, and who spoke to us about what was done with the human rights planks, the discussions what was included and what was not included, which we used as kind of a framework for our discussion. Also on the panel was Lisa Rudd, who is now in the state legislature, Av Gross, Attorney General, and Lee Gorsuch, who filled in at the very last moment for C.R. Lewis, who was to have been on the panel, and also for Sam Keto. The idea that anyone could represent the viewpoints of C.R. Lewis and Sam Keto, I think, is a little preposterous. But at any rate, Lee did a tremendous job of trying. I would say that we had a lively and, I think, interesting and provocative discussion. I think it would have been livelier and more provocative and more interesting had C.R. come. And I was sorry that there wasn't more challenge, more representation of perhaps a more conservative viewpoint. But it wasn't that we didn't try to get it, because we did. The Human Rights and Public Responsibilities Panel, as we were called, concluded after our discussion that the civil rights planks in the Article of the Constitution had provided a sound framework for the evolution of state law. There was virtually no sentiment in the panel or in the audience that any major changes were needed, but certain areas were singled out for special consideration. One area of concern and discussion was the question of native rights. It was pointed out that there was only one native actually attending the convention, and that the area of native rights did not get particular consideration at the convention, but that since the evolution of the native land claims, that certain new considerations ought to be at least thought about. And one was the idea of a right to preserve a culture and subsistence lifestyle. Panelist Lee Gorsuch felt that a recognition of the right to subsist might be considered. But then it was pointed out by Lisa Rudd that the new limitations on Arctic herds made it nearly impossible to consider a right to subsist, because it really wasn't possible to legislate to preserve a culture. Another area of native rights that was discussed was the right to receive an education near the place near your home. Avram Gross cited the Molly Hooch case and the effort of the state administration to solve this outside of the courts. Civil rights, he said, should be enforced by the executive and legislative branches as well as the judiciary. Lisa Rudd felt that the Section 3, the anti-discrimination planks, have provided the state with a framework unmatched by any other state, and it provided an atmosphere out of which the native claims could arise. Dorothy Holland explained that the anti-discrimination plank was way ahead of its time and of any similar planks in other state constitutions. The inclusion of sex in the anti-discrimination plank was discussed and rejected at the time in 1955, she said, because it was considered not to be needed in Alaska. We were naive, Mrs. Holland said. Sex was later included by amendment in 1972 after Alaska ratified the Federal Equal Rights Amendment. And Lisa Rudd pointed out that there was no enforcement teeth in the anti-discrimination plank until the Human Rights Commission was formed in 1963. Av Gross felt that the most important right of all was the right of privacy, which was proposed and rejected at the Constitutional Convention. It was added by amendment in 1972, and Dorothy Holland explained that at the convention, the right to privacy became bogged down in a debate over prohibition of wiretapping and other electronic devices. It was the only issue that their committee, she said, that inspired a minority report in 1955. But Gross felt that the right of privacy now had assumed vast new importance because of the 20 years since the convention, due to the development of sophisticated new devices for monitoring of homes, that it was even more important to have this protection. He pointed out that so far the only test of the right of privacy had been the controversial right to smoke marijuana in one's home. According to Dorothy Holland, the place of the grand jury and whether it should retain its right to investigate public matters was a particular concern of her committee. And the convention decided that the grand jury should be retained. But Attorney General Gross questioned whether the grand jury is really effective in protecting the public. The grand jury can investigate and report on anything they want, and there is nothing the accused can do about it, Gross said. But he had no better alternative to suggest. He also said that the right to bail, which is an absolute right in the Constitution, is one of the least understood of civil rights. Its only function is to make certain the defendant, who has not been proven guilty of anything, shows up. But it can be an emotional issue, as in the recent case in Anchorage of a sex offense against a minor. There were other suggestions about the justice system, such as an Australian provision that a not proven finding be added to guilty or not guilty pleas, and also suggestions that apparently were discussed at the Constitutional Convention that defendants should pay their own court costs. Despite concerns expressed about the justice system, Judge Buckelew, who was an original delegate and who was in our audience, said that he believed the quality of justice in the state of Alaska is superior to that of any other state. It was brought out that the Constitution was written in the 1950s during the era of Senator McCarthy and the investigations of the House on American Affairs Committee investigations. That's why the plank in the rights article, the right to fair and just treatment in legislative investigations, was included. But it's never been called into play because the atmosphere has changed since then, Attorney General Gross pointed out. And he said that now that has changed to a different aspect. In the 50s, there's also a plank on the right to assembly and right of association, which meant organizations didn't have to disclose their membership lists, and they were protected against this. Now we have the opposite. We have public disclosure laws. A recent example was the Anchorage organization Common Sense, which advocated positions and not specific candidates, and was therefore not required to disclose. There was also considerable attention given by the panel to rights in connection with education. The use of public money, and I'm not sure exactly how that went into this, the rights planks, but we seem to bring it in, to support private educational institutions seemed to be a concern to a lot of people. Constitutional Convention delegate Armstrong felt that public money to students should go only to accredited institutions. And yet, if standards are imposed, it was pointed out, it really isn't a question of private education at all anymore, but of what forms public education is going to take. There was concern expressed that the state university had grown a great deal since the days of the Constitutional Convention. And when we got into the area of talking about whether there should be a new constitutional convention, several people suggested that consideration of a different structure for running a state university ought to be considered. Most participants felt that there was not a need for another state constitutional convention in the near future, but some felt that it would be something to be feared, and some felt that it was not. It was brought out by Dorothy Holland that the convention was carried on in an atmosphere almost in a vacuum, and since there was no statehood at the time, and that if a new convention were held, many people feared hordes of lobbyists descending upon the delegates. And I think Lisa Rudd summed it up pretty well when she said that the Constitution has truly worked because it has been able to handle all sorts of problems and developments in the state of Alaska that were totally undreamed of 20 years ago when it was formed. So I think the conclusion of the group that was present was that a really superior job had been done by the Constitutional Convention, particularly in the area of human rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fanning. That's a very fine report. Is Tom Morehouse here? We'll have Mr. Morehouse present the summary to you as chairman of the executive branch workshop.
The executive branch workshop consisted of John Helenthal, who was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, John Borbridge, president and chairman of the board of the Sea Alaska Corporation, Andy Warwick, presently commissioner of administration, John Havelock, former attorney general, presently director of legal studies at the University of Alaska, and Chancey Croft, presently president of the Alaska State Senate. I think that the most important point and conclusion that was reached in the executive branch workshop is that the executive article of the Constitution, based on the concept of a strong executive, is fundamentally sound, and that it has worked to the benefit of Alaska and all Alaskans in statehood. In fact, a great deal of emphasis was placed on the necessity of a strong executive in Alaska to relate to big federal government, big labor, and big industry. It was pointed out that without a strong, unified executive force in Alaska, it might have been more difficult, and the outcomes, and some of the outcomes that are yet to come, might be less favorable to Alaska in areas of land claims, outer continental shelf development, the 200-mile limit, our access to our own oil and gas resources, without the unifying and force of a strong executive. It was also pointed out that the strong executive concept in Alaska and the values of accountability that go with it are particularly enhanced in a small state like Alaska, as are all of the other values of representative democracy. We looked at specific sections of the article after talking throughout the session about this basic concept that I've just conveyed to you. We looked at specific sections of the article, and there were no particular problems with any of them except for that relating to the selection of the lieutenant governor. It was agreed that it is a good thing that the lieutenant governor is a running mate of the governor in the general election, but it is not good that their pairing may be accidental after the primary. There was some concern or suggestion that there is some need to constitutionalize the arrangement reached by Governor Hammond and Lieutenant Governor Thomas, who teamed up before the primary. But there were no specific suggestions as to how that might be done or what language should be included in the Constitution. Discussion of the appointment and powers of the governor in relationship to the confirmation powers of the legislature, generally no great problems there, although I'll speak a little bit more about that further. Including no problems for the most part. In fact, general consensus that the concept of the appointed attorney general is desirable, and it is consistent, of course, with the strong executive concept. Section 26 boards, another section of the executive article, or related to the executive article, are inconsistent with the strong executive concept, but it was believed, and the consensus was, that it has not been a significant hindrance to strong executive leadership. The question was raised whether the strong executive concept, as laid out in the Constitution, has in practice been eroded in during the course of statehood since the Constitution was adopted. And the principal focus of that discussion of erosion, or possible erosion, was on executive-legislative relations. The points were made that the legislature has challenged the governor and has been in conflict with the governor over questions of the use of the governor's reorganization powers, the financial and budgeting powers of the governor, the appointment powers of the governor, the resource management responsibilities of the governor, such as in land selection, land trades, development of oil and gas resources or uses of oil and gas resources. Generally, the conclusion that was reached in that part of the discussion was that the strong executive has actually forced the legislature to be more responsible. and that the strong executive article is in practice becoming better balanced by a strong legislature. There was some discussion of new institutional elements that are arising in state government related to the executive branch, of course, unanticipated by the article itself. One is the different patterns of palace, quote, palace guards that governors have used to shield the governor because he has naked power, with the emphasis on naked rather than power, and that this was probably necessary and that his use of his staff was necessary to effectuate his office, that it may help shield him, but that may be necessary to some extent, that the uses of advisory boards and commissions may be a way of spreading responsibility, which is concentrated formally in his office, but that the way in which individual governors use them is their prerogative. Finally, we focused on another new major institutional innovation, which is possible, the permanent fund. Here, we discuss this as an innovation that will have, potentially, if it is adopted, a profound influence on the future of Alaska, but also on the role of the executive and the legislature in state policymaking. The question is whether a fourth branch of government may be created through creation of the permanent fund and its managers, who will have tremendous resources to use for purposes of investment in different directions within and without the state. In general, it was concluded and probably best expressed by John Borbridge that the principles and rights of self-determination and representative democracy underlay and define the whole statehood movement, the writing of the Constitution, and in particular the writing of the strong executive article, that there's a continuing need for the long-range planning, decision-making, and strong executive leadership which the article has conveyed to the state government in areas of land use, planning, resources, development, and conservation, and in continuing relationships with the federal government. The governor, under the executive article, is probably best described as the chief goal setter for the state of Alaska, who will have the responsibility now for the management of vast wealth, as opposed to the older and very difficult struggle for economic survival. That there is a continuing need for a strong executive to look at the whole spectrum of goals and means and to meld wise resource investment with social goals in the terms suggested to us by Paul Ilvesacker in his keynote address on Friday. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Morehouse. That was a very fine presentation. I neglected to note that you are a professor of political science at the Institute of Social and Economic Research here at the university. Now we would be pleased to hear from Andrew Kleinfeld, an attorney who is the chairman of the Judicial Forum. Andy, could you come?
Thank you, Governor Egan. Judge Ed Davis, a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, began our session with a review of some of the pre-statehood history of the judiciary in Alaska. He pointed out in particular that before statehood, the President of the United States appointed judges in Alaska, and these appointments were generally political appointments of people to whom the president or his party owed a debt, of people who often had no prior contact with the state. Some of them worked out well, some of them didn't. This was part of the background for Alaska's adoption of the modified Missouri plan that we have, a merit system of judicial selection. Judge Davis also pointed out an interesting, and as became clear from the discussion of the panel members a really very important aspect of the judiciary, and that is that by and large nobody is interested in it. Most court proceedings take place in a room occupied by the judge, the clerk, the lawyers, and if it's really important, the litigants come. Most of the proceedings, your clients don't show up, actually. It's not important enough to have them come to court. You certainly don't have members of the public beating down the doors to get into the courtroom. This might be viewed in what would really be a somewhat shallow view as apathy and a bad thing. The public isn't concerned enough about the judiciary. Judge Davis and the other panelists were inclined to think that this apathy might be something of a good thing. It might indicate a certain amount of satisfaction with the way the judiciary is functioning, a feeling that on the part of the general public that there is no need to beat down the doors of the courtroom and go in there and watch what they're doing because they're very unlikely to do much harm. And it is safe to stick to one's business and let them stick to theirs because they are going to do theirs in a reasonably fair and competent way. Judge Davis said that if he had to write the judiciary article again, he wouldn't change it at all. This was the feeling of, I think, all of the panelists and the members of the audience who were judges or lawyers or had some experience with this area. He was concerned with some of the administrative developments that are taking place just very recently in the court system. The panel was by no means just people congratulating each other on their success. There was considerable controversy on what you might call the subconstitutional or the administrative aspects of how the judiciary is presently developing. This controversy went along with considerable consensus on the constitutional aspects. In particular, Judge Davis felt that we are, by means of the appointment of judges, Superior Court judges for every little hamlet, in Alaska, fragmenting the court system overly and threatening the unified aspect of the court system. He also felt that the development, and this was no suggestion that there shouldn't be justice services provided for the rural areas, but that possibly the way we were doing it was causing too much fragmentation. He also felt that possibly there was a tendency to build empires and the judicial system was growing more than the caseload increases justified. Justice J. A. Rabinowitz commented that our judiciary article is very innovative and very different from the, it provides a judiciary which is very different from what other states have. And New York right now is attempting to reform its judicial system to make it like Alaska's. Justice Rabinowitz noted in particular the importance of the merit system here. In Pennsylvania and New York, during the years when our Constitution was written, judgeships were bought and sold in Pennsylvania and New York. That has not occurred in Alaska. There's never been so much as a whiff of it. That is tremendously important. One aspect of the Constitution which generated some controversy over the years was the tremendous power that the Constitution originally put in the Chief Justice and the Administrative Director of Courts. Alaska is unusual in having a unified court system. That means one court system run from the top for the whole state. No separate court systems for counties or cities, no municipal courts, no county courts, just a single hierarchy of courts. At the time when we also had a Chief Justice appointed for life and an administrative director appointed by and serving at the pleasure of that Chief Justice. This opened the door to a tremendous amount, a tremendous degree of coordination and efficiency. It also opened the door to tyranny. There was a great constitutional confrontation not too many years ago in Alaska between the Bar Association and the Chief Justice Nesbitt of the Supreme Court. Arose out of a conflict which I suppose might be put as whether the Bar Association was a separate or independent governmental entity, or whether it was a governmental entity under the judicial branch. And since the judicial branch was organized as a hierarchy run by the Chief Justice, under the Chief Justice, the wounds and sores of this confrontation seem to still smart a little, and nobody on the panel who'd been here then felt like talking about it. It was resolved by important constitutional amendments. One was that the Chief Justiceship is no longer a lifetime kind of job. When you were appointed Chief Justice, you used to be able to anticipate that so long as you didn't get caught in an embarrassing position late one night, you were going to be Chief Justice for the rest of your life, and nobody else was ever going to be your Chief Justice. That is no longer so. You serve now by being elected by the other justices for a term of 3 years, and you can't serve two terms in a row. You are always going to be an associate justice under one of your colleagues in no more than 3 years. Also, the administrative director, instead of serving at the pleasure of the chief, now is appointed by and serves at the pleasure of the entire court. So as a practical matter, it takes a majority of 3 members of the court to hire or fire him. These are reactions, essentially, to some of the problems that developed under the system of an extremely strong Chief Justice. Finally, Justice Rabinowitz pointed out that in this state, the rulemaking power is in the court. This is the power to make procedural rules over how lawsuits are going to proceed in court, what kind of papers people are going to file, how much time there's going to be between one paper and the next, that sort of thing. In a lot of states, the legislature makes those rules. It's the nature of those sorts of rules that they're really not very interesting to anybody except practicing lawyers and judges. And in states where the legislatures make them, you tend to get neglect of them and a certain lack of responsiveness and antiquity in your rules. Here, the rules have been more flexible, and it's been easier to develop them to the needs of the judiciary because the people who know something about them are writing them. The main problem that Justice Rabinowitz saw was that on the appellate level, which is, of course, the level he is most familiar with, there were 90 appeals a year in 1965 and 500 to 600 appeals a year now. And it's hard to keep the same quality of attention to each case, the same neighborly frontier kind of justice in a 500 to 600 appeal a year system that you can have in a 90 appeal a year system. Millard Ingram, a practicing lawyer and former president of the Alaska Bar Association, commented that he would agree that if he were drafting the Constitution today, it would say just what it says. He would make no changes from what it says. He too felt that the unified court system was extremely important in preventing local baronies, local deviations from patterns of law. One suggestion that Millard had, which does not go to the Constitution exactly. The Constitution says there shall be one Supreme Court, a Superior Court, and such other courts as the legislature might establish. And this suggestion really goes to whether the legislature ought to establish other courts and what sorts. There was some feeling that perhaps the district court, which is our court to handle small civil cases and misdemeanor criminal cases and provide bail setting and preliminary hearing in felonies, perhaps its function should be combined with the Superior Court for purposes of economy in the rural areas, so that you can have one judge in the town doing everything instead of having two, possibly one underworked on the Superior Court, and also for purposes of facilitating recruitment, since a lot of lawyers might be interested in serving on the court if they could do some Superior Court functions, but might be harder to recruit them to a district court. But particularly in the rural areas, this could be a significant means of economically extending judicial services. Miller had some question over whether the retention election had really served a useful function. As you know, a judge in this state is nominated by the Judicial Council, which has to nominate at least two persons for each slot. The governor appoints the judge from among the nominees of the Judicial Council, and then after a certain number of years, which differ according to level of court, the judge stands for election. And the question on the ballot is not, do you prefer Judge X or Judge Y, but shall we retain Judge X? The history of the retention elections is that the only time anyone on the panel could remember a judge being ousted by one was during the bar fight, when a Supreme Court justice who was not generally regarded as one of the bad judges we've had in the state by any means was ousted as a sort of proxy for the Chief Justice. There's been a history that if the Judicial Council and the bar tells the public that a judge is really terrible, the public figures that if the lawyers are against him, he must be great, and they all vote for him, and he gets in by the biggest vote of any of them. Nevertheless, there is some support for the retention elections. They can be used as a thwart to tyranny. The vote with respect to Justice Aaron probably did send the message to Chief Justice Nesbitt. There was some concern by Millard Ingram that the change in the constitutional provision on the administrative director of courts was not an unmitigated blessing. Justice Rabinowitz had suggested that by having the administrative director serve at the pleasure of the entire court rather than the Chief Justice, you eliminated cronyism and professionalized the position. Millard Ingram suggested that this also made it a lot less likely that the fellow was going to get canned as a practical matter, gave him a lot more independence, and one effect could be that he would feel a lot freer to develop a self-perpetuating and greatly growing bureaucracy in the administrative office of courts, because he was just less answerable as a practical matter, as you always are when you answer to a committee instead of an individual. Panelist Peter Ashenbrenner, a practicing lawyer and United States magistrate in Fairbanks, suggested that retention elections have been a problem, partly because of the lack of information that the public has about the judges, and suggested that this might be improved to some extent by the new program of the Judicial Council in distributing information about the judges, distributing how the judges did on polls of the people who have familiarity with their courts, other judges, lawyers, police officers, and so forth. Ashenbrenner was also concerned that we may face some significant changes, and it's hard to predict what they are because of the tremendous public hostility to lawyers and the feeling that lawyers are an exclusive club that the public is not entirely happy with. Art Hippler, professor of anthropology, discussed the difficulties that we've had in providing justice to the rural areas of the state. These difficulties are created partly by the expense of travel to the rural areas and the expense of building courthouses out there, jails, sending judges out, clerks, public defenders, prosecutors, lawyers, and partly by cultural differences that make it difficult to simply use the same mold that we use in Anchorage out in any village that the courts happen to serve. Dr. Hippler suggested that before the Alaska Purchase, very little was done to maintain order in rural communities. He suggested that without any sort of justice system, disputes tended to be resolved on the basis of strength, family, and friends, rather than any principles of justice. He disapproved of simply applying the notion of cultural relativism and saying, well, if this is the way they want to do it, fine, suggesting that maybe this is the way the strong wanted to do it, but not necessarily the way the weak wanted to do it. And he felt that the extension of our system of law, being some system of law with some principles of justice, was a highly beneficial thing. However, the main means of extension which had been used so far, the use of magistrates, lay magistrates in the bush, Hippler felt was an unmitigated disaster. One thing that he noted was that the volume of problems put before the magistrates was far smaller than the volume of problems that had previously been put to village councils. He also felt that because of family patterns, magistrates often were not regarded as impartial judges of the sort that we think judges ought to be. They might represent one group or another in the village, with hostilities between that group and another group in the village, as is likely in any small community where people know each other, perhaps all too well in some cases. He felt that one possible means of reforming this area was the use of conciliation panels, which he and Steve Kahn, a lawyer who has worked on this with Dr. Hippler, have developed. The conciliation panels are a sort of arbitration system that have been experimented with in some of the rural communities. Hippler also felt that itinerant judges, traveling judges, might be a better solution than magistrates in areas where the conciliation panels by themselves couldn't do the job. Several members of the audience had a great deal to contribute. Delegate Maynard Lonberg suggested that as the rural population of Alaska is getting a larger number of educated people, the use of magistrates might become somewhat more acceptable than it has been in the past. He gave the analogy that a nurse isn't as good as a doctor, but it's a lot better than not having any health services in your village at all, and a magistrate might be the same way. Delegate Les Nerland wondered if it was just what the degree of consensus was among lawyers on the modified Missouri plan that we have. He commented that some lawyers had told him that they would have been happier with a system of elected judges, but the consensus of the people on the panel was that this was the view of a very small minority of lawyers, maybe 10%, and that there is a very strong consensus of the lawyers in the state that things are a lot cleaner under appointed judges than they ever would be under elected judges, and we have a much higher quality of judges. Judge Buckaloo, also a delegate to the convention, noted that the rural representation which the Constitutional Convention had was really very important. He also favored maintaining the retention elections, even if they had not succeeded in ousting some of the less qualified judges, partly because of their good effect on the judge himself, that it's good for the judge himself to know that one day he is going to face a retention election, and if he acts too outrageously, he may have some trouble in it. Judge Buckaloo did suggest that the 10-year term between retention elections for Supreme Court justices is too long and that it ought to be shorter. Some of the complexities that were discussed involved the hardest problem that was discussed is the problem of serving the rural areas of the state. There is no consensus on how to do this among the people who know about the problems. The problems are very difficult. We're now experimenting with various solutions, and it isn't clear which, if any of them, are the right ones to use. It is clear that it's an important problem to which attention has to be devoted. Judicial selection has worked extremely well in this state, and there's, I think, real trepidation among judges and lawyers in the state regarding change in judicial selection. Since there is no law school in Alaska, every lawyer here has some experience in another state. He knows something about another state where he went to law school. And in almost every case, he knows that the judiciary in that other state is not as good as the judiciary here. In some, there's just blatant corruption. People buy their seats on the bench. In some, it's not like that, but all the same, you wouldn't want to be arguing a case against a lawyer who'd been the major contributor to the judge's reelection fund. In no state that any of us were aware of does the system of appointment of judges, which is really of critical importance, work as well as it does here. There are problems with the system of retention elections. Nobody is entirely happy with how that's worked out. There's some discussion of perhaps increasing the role of the Commission on Judicial Qualifications and reducing the role of retention elections, but people are reluctant to make any very substantial change in this area because while the retention elections haven't worked terribly well at ousting bad judges, they have not been a terrible disaster either. And we are all familiar with other states that do have disastrous patterns of their judiciaries, and we are a bit scared of reform on account of that. The rotating of the Chief Justice is probably an extremely important constitutional reform that has been made, has already been accomplished. I would say that one very important factor that came out in the discussion is that a constitution is more than a document. It also consists of many years of historical development. You get an accretion around a constitution, an accretion of custom and tradition and assumptions about how people ought to behave. We've had a state judiciary since, I think it was organized a year after statehood, 1960. And during the period between then and now, we've developed a lot of historical accretions that aren't mentioned in our Constitution, but are very important to making it work. One example is the way the Judicial Council has worked. It is not intrinsic in the document establishing the Judicial Council that it will be as pure and merit-oriented and non-political and free of corruption and cronyism as it is. It's worked out that way because the men on the Judicial Council have established a tradition of high-mindedness and caring about appointment of good judges, and because without any constitutional requirement that they do so, they've established a tradition of polling the entire bar of the state and all the judges of the state on applicants and paying respectful heed to the opinions of those people in the state who know about the applicants, the responses on these polls. This is not required by the Constitution. It's required by an historical tradition that's grown up under the Constitution. What this means is that if you change the Constitution, you're going to change more than a document. You're going to change the pattern of accretion of customs and traditions. And because they are complex, because they are unwritten in most cases, it's very hard to predict just what the changes will be. The feeling of most of us on the, I think the feeling of all of us on the panel was a very vigorous consensus against change of the judiciary article. All of us have familiarity with other states, and in no state that any of us are familiar with do we have as good a judiciary as we have here. It is not simply a matter of being satisfied with what we have. It's a matter of being militantly supportive of what we have because we are well aware of the alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andy. That was also a very fine presentation. And now we will request that Jim Dugan come down and act as the chairman of the local government workshop in making the presentation. Chairman Malott is not here this morning. Yes, Jim, we appreciate your work here.
Thank you, Bill. I'm not the, or wasn't the chairman of the local government committee. Byron Malott was, but he had to leave and go back home, and so he asked me to make the report for the local government workshop. It was quite an interesting workshop to attend and sit in on. I was fortunate that yesterday Vic Fisher, who was supposed to sit in, was unable to sit in and asked me to take his place. With me on the panel, of course, were Byron.
Speak up a little bit, please.
With me on the panel was Byron Malott, who used to be the director of the community and regional agency in Governor Egan's cabinet. Lee Sharp, a former borough assemblyman and presently municipal attorney for the city and borough of Juneau. Mike Harper, who is the deputy director of the Community and Regional Affairs Agency under the present Governor Hammond. Ben Marsh, who is a former assemblyman and city manager of the city of Anchorage. And I guess that's all. The panel started off, of course, with a brief history of what the local government article was and what it was intended. There seemed to be a great deal of concern about the local government article in that it seemed to be somewhat vague in many areas, that it could have been much more specific, but I think that after discussion, it was realized that to try and be any more specific than what it was would might have caused a great many problems. The main consensus seemed to be that the local government article was not implemented as other articles of the Constitution were directly after statehood, because there was so much to be done in setting up the state government, and this is one of the areas that that kind of was set aside for a period of time, and it wasn't until the Mandatory Borough Act was enacted by the legislature that much was done in the way of setting up local government areas different from what had been the traditional local government areas throughout the territorial days. In adopting the Mandatory Borough Act, it caused a great many problems. Power struggles developed. Those were some of the things that were unforeseen, I think, by the delegates at the Constitutional Convention. But the power struggles did develop, and there was a great deal of recrimination between cities, borough governments, in trying to get together and see if they couldn't unify, make themselves into one metropolitan government. And unification seems to be the vehicle that is solving those problems. For the most part, the local government articles seem to serve the metropolitan areas of the state quite well in its present condition. The rural areas of the state, of course, are the ones that are suffering because of lack of effort on the part of the legislature in implementing the local government article. But fortunately, as far as I'm concerned, the present deputy director announced that the Community and Regional Affairs Agency is in the process now of preparing ordinances to present to the legislature, who they hope will sit as the assembly for the unorganized boroughs of the state and get some local government effort going in that direction. Home rule, as envisioned by the delegates, has not worked as well as they felt that it should have, because the home rule decisions and what it is have been made by the courts rather than by the legislature. And the first home rule decision made by the courts is about 180 degrees from what it seemed that the intent of the delegates to the convention were. There has been other decisions made subsequently that are tending to bring back the intent of home rule to the concept that was envisioned by the delegates, and the matters have not been resolved entirely as yet, but in time they feel that the intent of the local government article will be back where it was intended. The service area concept in the local government article seemed to cause a great deal of concern, but again, the definitions of what a service area are have not been clearly explained through legislation, and that in time it is hoped that the legislature will address itself to that concept and to others and set guidelines so that the disputes that have risen between municipalities and boroughs in trying to set up service areas will become a thing of the past. John Havelock attended as a guest at the workshop and very ably took the position of the devil's advocate and started out by saying that the local government article was a disaster area purely for the purposes of